Bob O'Sullivan. I sometimes go by the name of Mr. O'Silly Pun, and you might be, if you have real trouble with puns, you might want to leave right now, and it might be more pleasant for all of us. Occasionally, I have great difficulty restraining from engaging that behavior. This session, as you may recall, had the title of something like Light Brain, Deaf Brain, and then I made some mention about it having something to do with the crisis of whites. You might wonder why I called it Light Brain, Deaf Brain. It's fairly simple. I am left-handed, and there's been a lot of medical and other research that indicates that the left side of the body and the left hand and all that are connected with the right side of the brain. And somehow I just didn't like the idea of the right side, against which I have quite a bit of prejudice of the rest of my body and the rest of the world, getting the credit for controlling my left-handedness. So I decided to look for other ways of talking about it. And I also thought that the two phrases I used instead of right brain, left brain, about which you may be familiar, that the terms light and deft kind of fit how those two particular sides of the brain function, and also they conveniently rhyme, and I just found them irresistible. A little about myself. I'm left-handed and spent much of my life in schools, including Missouri Synod pre-theological schools, in which I always felt that I didn't fit. And I wasn't real sure why, although there were some fairly obvious cues. My name was O'Sullivan, and most of my classmates had names like Schierschlicht or Schliepsig, actually wound up marrying a woman whose last name is Wildermuth and occasionally gives concerts under the rather ungodly name of Alice Wildermuth O'Sullivan. How many of you are left-handed, by the way? You're raising the wrong hand. looks like 4 or 5 of you. Someone earlier asked, most estimates is that somewhere between 9 to 13 or 14% of the population is left-handed. And that's true pretty much throughout the world. I understand it's a recessive gene type thing, although in some families, and you may know some, there are a lot of left-handers that develop, and I don't know if you do proper breeding, we might increase our percentages significantly. A lot of left-handers, I think, over the years, and you may think of left-handers that you know yourself, are kind of a little different. And the ways they're different may vary quite a bit, but there's often a thought of them being kind of odd. Historically, for a long time, it was not only a matter of their being thought to be odd, sometimes they were thought to be evil. The Latin word for left-hander is sinister. One English word that we use a lot, the word awkward, the word awk, from which it derives, originally meant bad or evil, and then it slowly drifted into meaning left, and the combination of sinister and awkward are two things that a lot of people over the years have thought of about left-handers. And there's a lot of prejudice in the language. I brought a copy of Roger's Thesaurus, which I borrowed from the room next door without checking with the board of directors, but I suspect this is all right. And I looked up left and found the following words for left-handed: clumsy, insulting, oblique, And then you can look in each of those and find a little more that kind of rubs it in. Now, there is a certain form of clumsiness that a fair number of left-handers have. The kind of, in my mind, the quintessential clumsy left-hander was Jerry Ford. I don't know if you remember, but he was always kind of stumbling down airport things. And the finest example of a kind of cultural clumsiness was the time when he was given a tamale in a husk, and he ate the whole thing. And that was recorded photographically and showed what the old French word for left-handed gauche really meant. In a lot of languages, right, like in Latin, dexter, in French, I don't know how to pronounce French, but we have the word adroit that comes from, I guess it's le droit or something like that, which not only means right-handed, but it has the full power of being the law in French. And you'll just find in almost all the languages of the world a real sort of prejudice that in one way associates left-handedness with either being sinister and evil or also with the idea of being clumsy. And the linguistic prejudices are not unlike those about blacks or those about women. Real similarities there. Anyway, in recent years, there's been a lot of research about the human brain. And I have found it fascinating because it speaks rather directly to why a lot of left-handers indeed are different. And I am at this point going to say some caveats, some things that I don't want to overgeneralize, and the research is not totally clear. And to say left brain, right brain, or deft brain, light brain is not totally accurate because we have one brain. And I sometimes, just to confuse you a little more with my wordplay, like to call it the cleft brain. The word cleave is one of the most wonderful words in the English language because it has two meanings which are directly opposite to each other. Mm-hmm. To cleave means to cling, to, you know, you leave your parents and you cleave to this woman and you become one flesh. But cleave also has the meaning of cut. A meat cleaver cuts things in half. And so if you call something a cleft brain, you can talk about it being united, it being one brain, but also it is divided. It also has two distinct parts, and a lot has been learned about those. How were they learned? By a variety of methods. It was sort of first noticed in the last century in relationship to some people who had strokes or been injured in one way or another, and found out that, the stroke must have affected the one hemisphere of the brain, and someone would have aphasia whereby they could barely speak or not be able to form words at all, or other things might happen if the other side of the brain were affected. And in recent years, both the medical science and neurology, or whatever you want to call it, have advanced an awful lot more. And at the same time, unfortunately, people not only have had a good number of strokes, but there have been serious injuries brought about by accidents and wars where, unfortunately, a lot of people were found who had something seriously affecting one or the other hemispheres of the brain, and in the process they noticed what they could and could not do, and in that process they started saying, aha, such and such a function must be located in one or the other hemispheres of the brain. But again, it's not real simple. You can't say, oh yes, this function is specifically always on the one side of the brain. And indeed, in left-handers, the location of certain functions are often not quite where they are in right-handers. And the human brain apparently, and I'm not a science person, so I've read a lot in this area, but please don't assume that I know a great bit of about the scientific of it other than what I've read, that children don't really have a great differentiation in brain function. It starts to develop about the age of 9 or 10. And indeed, sometimes children who've had one side of the brain injured before that time quickly develop things that are almost impossible for an adult to develop in the other side of the brain as they are young and adaptable in terms of what goes on in their brain, apparently. The brain is absolutely amazing. It is more complex and intricate than any computer. There are an incredible number of things going on in there. But basically, there are kind of two ways of thinking, acting, perceiving the world that go on in the two hemispheres of the brain, and I have put them on the board in a kind of deft brain way. If I were to try and approach this from the other side, I'd be rambling all over the place like a jazz solo, and you might get it out that way. But since we only have an hour and we want to do some talking and all that, I've chosen to neatly divide it, and I'm going to kind of quickly talk about it. And just so I don't totally confuse you, when we're saying light, we are talking about the right hemisphere of the brain. When I say deft, we are talking about the left hemisphere of the brain. The light hemisphere tends to be holistic, and some people spell that with a W and some don't, so I gave you the option of perceiving it whichever way you please, but it's a question of getting the whole picture. While the left side tends to concentrate on the particular. Someone might, with the one hemisphere, see a whole scene, while the other person might see a wart or some particular detail. The light hemisphere tends to be intuitive, just going on the basis of hunch, of intuition, while the deft hemisphere tends to be logical. The light one is visually oriented. Of the West's greatest artists, the following were left-handed: Raphael, Michelangelo, Leonardo. One aside here, in the case of Michelangelo, he was left-handed, but he taught himself to paint with his right hand some to get some of the places in the Sistine Chapel where he couldn't quite get with his left hand, and so he trained himself to use his right hand to get those. Michelangelo, Gauguin, Hans Holbein, Matisse, Van Gogh, Picasso, Dali, they were all left-handers. And if I thought a little more, I could probably name 4 or 5 others, kind of 15 out of 20 of the greatest artists of the West, and probably the most the way most people would rank them. And this is consistent with the fact that the right brain is visually oriented. Left brain or deft brain tends to be verbally oriented. It's where we have most of our verbal skills, syntactical skills, and generally the ability to form words. The right brain tends to be imaginative, playful often, while the left brain is intellectual. The right brain is physical and visceral. A lot of body things involving movement, dance, athletics, sexuality are generally centered in the right hemisphere, while the other hemisphere tends to be more cerebral and involved in thinking rather than physicality. The light hemisphere generally is a center of emotions, while the left hemisphere tends to be more governed by rules and is oriented toward information. The light hemisphere, and again, this is not totally true, but because both hemispheres are very definitely involved in the creation of music, it tends to be musical and rhythmic, while mathematical functions are almost totally found in the deft hemisphere. Poetry and words in design. One book, and I notice it's in the bookstore, is called, Writing the Natural Way, talks about these two things, this as the design mind, this as sign mind. Sign would be just a quick identification of she is a woman. Design would be more like a poetic thought, and maybe something. The book quotes John Updike, where he uses a lot of W-type words in describing women. Warm, womb-like, women, just more of a pattern than just words as specific signs. The memory functions of the right hemisphere involve things like remembering songs and images, while the memory on the left hemisphere tends to be more computer-like. There have been cases, in fact, some of the earliest research was sort of prompted by this, where people had had strokes or accidents whereby they could hardly form a intelligible word. You've maybe known such people, but at the same time, they might be able to sing a song that they knew from childhood, or a liturgical snatch of the liturgy, or something like that. They might not be able to frame a sentence, or it might be a very, very poor sentence, but they'll be able to sing and remember without stuttering or anything a song that is deep back in their memory. There's a word here I kind of made up. It's actually originally a term from McLuhan, I think, the idea of moving mosaic. Mosaical has a nice sort of Old Testament kind of ring to it, and that's a little like how the light brain functions. Ideas and images move around, and it's like that mosaic that McLuhan sometimes talked about when he was talking of television. While the deft or left hemisphere tends to be sequential, one thing right after another, linear in a straight line. Consistent with that, stream of consciousness typewriting. James Joyce, who was one of my great loves, would write in this wonderful stream of consciousness type form, while the type of writing that would be more likely to produce by the deft hemisphere functions would be like a legal brief or a Missouri Synod Book of Dogmatics.
Yes.
The light hemisphere tends to be able to process and handle information simultaneously. A lot of things go on at the same time, and that's sort of the way it functions. While the deft hemisphere is much more likely to be a point by point, one thing leads to another in processing information, if I may use a deft brain type term. Again, the light hemisphere gets the big picture. Jung's term of a gestalt fits there, while the deft hemisphere would concentrate more on specific details. Where the deft hemisphere might be highly verbal, talk, 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 the right light hemisphere might be quiet and produce words and thoughts in, to use another biblical term, a kairotic sort of way. Kairos, we've heard as a documents about South Africa and about now Central America, but in its New Testament sense, it has to do with the appropriate time. In the King James, I think it was translated when the fullness of time had come. Instead of a click, click, click chronological time, it's
It's when things should be produced that they are produced. It's when the right time happens. I'm showing a prejudice here, but it's not real clearly demonstrated as to exactly where a cerebral funny bone is located, but it's fairly consistent with the rest of this, that lighthearted people would be using their light hemisphere, while the functions on this side tend to be a little more serious. I mentioned earlier the idea of design and sign mind. And finally, two words that maybe relate to my perceptions and prejudices here, levity in the sense of lightness going up in the air, and levity in the sense of humor are, of course, in the light hemisphere, while gravity and all the grave things that are related to it are perhaps located there. On the bottom here, I put a few of the words I mentioned earlier. Sinister, gauche, awkward, oblique are English language and other language kind of heavily loaded words about left-handed one way or another. While positive words like dexterity and dexterous and adroit and indeed the word right itself associated with the right hand and the deft hemisphere. I do not want to say that everybody should become left-handed and all that's involved there, but I do think that there is, in many people in European and American cultures, a real overbalance on this side. Think about going to school. How many things are related to verbal, in this sense, mathematical, logical, and how much time do you spend on these things in school? These are the solids, these are the electives. And it's a strong cultural unbalance that I think has happened in the Western world, probably since the time of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. And if I may dare to make a leap from there, I think a fair amount of what's unbalanced in white American society is related to the fact that these things are so heavily valued and these things tend to be undervalued. Now, I realize this has been a quick run through an awful lot of information and material, but I have personally found all of this research to be fascinating. I think I understand myself a lot better, and I think it gives us some real cues to think about who we are in the world today. Some people look at these and say, wow, this is masculine, this is feminine. I don't know. There certainly are curious and interesting crossovers there. But in many societies, especially third world societies, I think there's a lot better balance. I lived in Africa for a while, and where in our society, working males might often be sitting at a desk and dealing with calculators, and it used to be slide rules, now other things, and valuing stuff over here. Men in Africa might also be very much involved in music and dance as part of their everyday life in ways that are really almost unknown in much of the Western world. And what I'd like to see and suggest is we probably should find ways to balance ourselves better, to expand in the hemisphere where we maybe don't do as much or explore as much, and in the process become more whole and full human beings. Well, I've talked quite a bit and explored all sorts of waterfronts reactions, questions, jabs to the jaw with your right or whatever. Yes?
Yeah, I find that very interesting because I can remember I went through up to the middle of the third grade in Wheeling, West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And the teachers taught the kids to write with right hands. They would not even allow you to write with your left hand. And as an electrician and an artist, I've taught myself to use my left hand to get to places I can't reach.
Like Michelangelo. Yeah.
With my right hand.
Yeah.
And it was an older electrician that suggested I do that as an apprentice by saying, well, what happened if you lost a finger off your right hand?
Uh-huh.
And when you're using a tool, you really know how important each finger plays in the using of that tool. So I learned to use my left hand with the tool as well as my right hand.
There's been some fascinating information about the question of people who are forced to it's almost always, I don't know too many people are forcing children to write with their left hand, but the opposite, which was not all that uncommon until, 30, 40 years ago. And I've heard horror stories of nuns with rulers and people with their arms tied behind their back and all sorts of other things. And that often relates to mental illness type things that happen and to stuttering. One of the most famous natural left-handers who was forced to write with his right hand was Lewis Carroll. And Lewis Carroll had a serious stuttering problem all his life. And he certainly was one of the most light brain dominant of people, but he had real problems, perhaps well related to the fact that he was forced to write right-handedly when he naturally would have written with his left. Yes?
I don't think whether you're right brain or left brain dominant is really related to handedness.
It's not directly and absolutely. Clearly it's not.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned, the functions, especially of left-handers in the brain, tend to be a little more diffuse than they are of right-handers. And I know some left-handers who are like very mathematically oriented. And I know some right-handers that are great artists. I started by saying this is really complex and I don't want to oversimplify anything. But there is a way in, just like so many of those great artists were left-handers, there is a way of saying that in many cases someone who is left-handed might also have real signs of right brain dominance or light brain dominance.
You know, what strikes me more is if you're going to be spiritual, you're going to have to be intuitive.
Uh-huh.
You're going to have to get into the right side of your brain.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a rational left brain activity.
Sure. It's, I think, very true. And relating to that on balance, I think Lutherans should be thankful that they have ritual, which probably relates to the visual and the poetic and the intuitive a lot more than all the teaching and preaching tends to be. And if Lutherans didn't have that, they'd probably really be messed up spiritually. Yes?
I'm a Spanish teacher, and I've done a fair amount of reading recently in what I consider to be the state-of-the-art thinking about teaching languages. And there's, I guess, over the last, possibly, I think no more than 10 or 15 years in this country at least, there's been a lot of thinking and writing about making education a balanced activity, so that you learn a language more, you know, with a lot of music, with very colorful posters, with communicative and meaningful and fun interactions, you know, using legends and stories, and a lot of very more sort of poetic and musical things, as opposed to strictly grammatical memorization or, you know, I mean, when I learned German in high school, it was more like almost like a mathematical class. Mm-hmm. This follows this, and this is the structure of the grammar and so on. So it's interesting to hear you talking about it. And I mean, I think throughout education there's a strong movement to make education more holistic.
Yeah, I've been involved in what's generally known as the Writing Project movement, which has really revolutionized how writing is taught in schools throughout the United States, and it's going in other parts of the world. And one of the things that is strongly emphasized by a lot in that is when people are organizing their thoughts for writing, do what's often called clustering or webbing or brainstorming, where I don't want to erase all that, but is there it's Cork or something like that, a county from which my relatives come. But what it would be just say you're dealing with a subject. Give me a subject.
Spiders.
Well, let's try math first. What else comes to your mind when you think of math? You might put math here in the center. What else comes to mind?
Numbers.
Okay, over here you put numbers. And does that give you other ideas related to numbers itself?
It gives an absence of no color.
Okay. And they're rid of the decimal way of dealing with numbers, and they even had a name for it, a system based on 12 rather than 10, because you can divide 12 by 3 and 4 and 6 and 2 and all of that. This would really confuse a lot of people, but it sounds fun. And then you might think about different forms of mathematics. You might think about algebra and trig. And anyway, you'll be putting circles here and there, and you might be putting arrows and or spider web type lines or whatever between one and another. And then kind of before you write, you might just sort of look at that cluster or web, or you might try and get it organized a little better. You know, when I was in school, I did that kind of thing. I didn't know it was socially acceptable. But their teachers had us do outlines, which, you know, goes with Pieper's dogmatics and all of that sort of stuff. And the outlines often were phony and often something we did after we did the paper. Clustering or webbing or whatever you want to call this is a kind of holistic, image-oriented, visual, non-sequential way of organizing stuff, and a way that's real, real valuable. Yes?
There's a neat book in the library that I have to have at home called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain.
Yeah.
All kinds of exercises like that in it to help you use the right side of your brain.
Yeah.
I found it wonderful. Interesting book.
You mentioned the outlining. I was taught, of course, in seminary to outline your 3 points and your concluding poem or whatever at the end.
Like the 5-paragraph essay.
You know, I always resisted that terribly. It took me a number of years to get to the point where I just don't outline. My husband still does, but instead I just sit down and see what evolves, which generally kind of takes its own life and just goes its own way, and it's kind of fun to see where it goes. But it took a long time to realize that this outline business was, for the most part, that once in a while it seems to work okay, but for the most part just was not the way for me.
Yeah.
It was so clear in seminary, that's how you do it.
And I preach sometimes, and sometimes my sermons are, or you might discern some sort of logical outline to them. but at other times, almost deliberately, it's more like a jazz improvisation. And I'm speaking a couple days on another screwy combinations of subjects, talking about the sort of ultimate oxymoron, jazzy Lutherans. Just real briefly, my wife and I, she is a musician, and she was recently asked about a year and a half ago to be the music director of Will Herzfeld's church in Oakland, which is largely black. And I'm going to, I think, play a snatch of a recording of a concert they did there, partially because the jazz solos in it are so wonderful. And when you hear that, I think you'll maybe make a little more sense of what I'm trying to say right now, that the soaring improvisation that goes on there, it can be a real valid and beautiful way of communicating, even though, and it has its own interior organization, and it's incredible that someone can do this while putting it together. And yet that's a free communicative way that so far goes beyond what happens in this rather dull way of perceiving and relating to reality. Yes?
I think an interesting part of the cleft brain possibility, and picking up on what you were talking about with the writing processes, is to imagine recursively that, you know, of you dip back into all of that brainstorming and imaginative stuff in order, not just in order to, but then move out of that into a more communicable attempt.
Yeah, and part of the writing project movement, and I know you just recently were involved in what's called, what was it, South Coast Writing Script or something like that. It's one of those. It is that it emphasizes that writing is a process, that you don't expect anyone to come up with a finished product on their first draft. And indeed, a lot of, quote, pre-writing activities like the webbing, brainstorming, and so forth are probably more important than some of the actual writing itself, because those are tools and getting it organized a lot better. And when you see it a process, then you start seeing people being very skilled. And sometimes they might be using one tool. I tend to use things like alliteration and excessive punning and whatever, but at other times you might want to use another skill. But it's a process in which you're crafting something. And it's fascinating, a good point. Yes?
I'm thinking about sort of the irony of you and lots of people getting more into the light side of things in a time in our culture, really, where all of the major institutions and, in fact, probably the major intellectual currents lead us toward the other side, right? And I guess I'm thinking particularly of the sciences, both hard sciences, physical sciences, and social sciences, and how whatever there used to be of the light side in the sciences seems, at least in the academy, to be increasingly invisible. More and more the servant of counting stuff.
Yeah, you know, the
being able to quantify.
The bean counters and all that.
That's right. And there's a sense in which this the sort of, there's something about the deft side that is a push toward quantification and toward certainty about stuff, which the sciences sort of push us to do too. And lots of our institutions push us toward that.
Oh,
I'm just wondering about.
I don't feel competent at all to say too much about what's going on in sciences now. I sort of figure that maybe if I don't think about it, it'll go away. But it's real fascinating to read about Einstein, who, when he was talking about how he developed his theories, it was an awful lot of intuition and aha type experiences that indeed do fit over here. I do see some hope in, and I don't know that much about it, but in ways in which people dealing with computers
sometimes are kind of getting in that sphere, that rather than what one might expect, they might get into it in their own discovery and working out of software and that sort of thing. Incidentally, my wife and I recently got a Macintosh computer, and although it can do a lot of real deft type things, it also can be wonderfully light in enhancing one's creativity. And with a lot of the visual stuff, I, who despite my left-handedness don't have much in the way of artistic talent, all of a sudden can create real interesting things through desktop publishing type ways. But I do fear that you're largely right about the direction of much of modern science, but I don't feel I know much to say about that.
Let me just add one more foot.
Sure.
It could be that what's going on is that, in fact, the leaders in a variety of scientific fields do operate on the light side of the brain very often. The writings of the great scientists, from Einstein to Boswell, for example, are filled with those moments, that kind of imagination. But the tools that we're getting now, including, I suppose, primarily the computer, seems to me to sort of lock the populace, the rest of us, the general public, who are not aha frontier type scientists, into counting stuff more and more. I mean, the Macintosh maybe is an exception to that.
I have the sense that a lot of the aha stuff is really going on in experimental physics, but I don't know much about it.
Yeah.
There's a good article on that in this month's Discover magazine on the principle of uncertainty and the leap of faith that it takes.
Yeah.
Do you know that Einstein quote, imagination is more important than knowledge?
No, I guess I didn't. I do remember reading some of the stuff about his real aha intuitive kind of experiences. And in the humanities, or in literature specifically, I am delighted at the lingering and in some ways not dominant but strong influences of people like Blake and Joyce, who are a couple of my main men. I mean, it's amazing how many people you wouldn't think would be influenced by such indeed are. Yeah.
Bob, correct me if I'm off base, but is what I'm hearing or what you may be trying to suggest, as we get more locked in, particularly through technology, on the depth side of the brain, are we getting to be even that much more self-centered as an individual?
Well, I'm not sure if self-centered is quite the term I'd use, but unbalanced. Nowhere near fully experiencing our potential. And I was, before we got started, I was talking a little about my own experience in having, for much of my life, been very, very left-handed. My right hand was essentially an appendage that I hung a wristwatch on before I realized when William Blake said the hours of folly are measured by the clock, and of wisdom no clock can measure. But I broke my left wrist playing basketball and still had to do certain things like write and type and stuff around the house and whatever. And I was pleasantly surprised at how easily, once I had to learn to do things with my right hand, I could. And I've sometimes joked about forming something that I would call ambisinistrality training, trying to make left-handers the equivalent of ambidextrous. But I wouldn't want to be ambidextrous. That's way too right-handed. So I want to be ambisinister.
But once that happened, okay, and you're looking at concrete physical things that you had to learn to do with the unnatural hand, so to speak, Did you look back on that experience and notice things that were invisible that you grown to see?
Well, I'm not sure if this is what you're getting to with it, invisibility, but I learned that I really could do things that I didn't think I could do. And I was also saying earlier about women who do clothes work. I've known men, knitting, crocheting, whatever, needlepoint and that, I've known men who've been interested and tried it. And they gave up real quick because it just seemed beyond them, and or hard or something like that. And I bet you if they kept at it, they could get pretty good at it. About use of both hands, musicians, especially keyboard people, but others, I mean, it's amazing what they can do with both.
I mean, let's say if you read a story before you lost the use of your left side, and after learning to use your right side in the absence of using your left side, could you read that same story and pull something else out of it that you hadn't thought before?
Yeah, quite possibly, I think. Yes.
Well, don't people like dentists and many surgeons have to learn to use a left hand when they're right-handed and practice like fury to do that?
Yeah.
And that's close work.
Yeah.
And, better be.
And in basketball, I used to go to extreme measures not to have to use my right hand. I used it one way. It was my feeder hand. Or a hand I would use while doing hand fakes. Marshall can tell you about my hand fakes. I'd have a ball here, and I couldn't jump. I had the white man's disease. And because I couldn't jump, I'd get other people to jump. You know, I'd take a left, my basic shot's a left-handed hook shot, and I sometimes joke that my sports autobiography should be titled Born to Hook. And so I would fake, and I would just use my right hand to hold the ball, and then the other guy would jump, and I could just go around him. But I sometimes would do, I don't know if it's safe to demonstrate basketball moves in here, but I would sometimes do essentially 360-degree moves to avoid using my right hand. Let's say the basket's over here, and I'm here. I'd do something like this. Mm-hmm. So that I didn't have to do something which was relatively simple with my right hand. And curiously, some of that has to do with footwork. And the most important thing in a hook shot is what goes on with the legs, and not the arm in that, because if the leg work is wrong, you're going to mess up. And only when people started always guarding me to go to my left, would I really start going to my right and do a little behind-the-back dribble, and they'd be going there and I'd be going here. But I guess what I'm saying from my own experience is you can do lots of things you might have no idea you could do unless you really, really do it. And that's pretty basic, and I think our culture is sadly lacking in lots of things because of the dominance of the bean counters. Yes.
But I think the Russians have a policy, I'm not sure, that nobody's left-handed.
Do they?
I think that was the way it was some years ago. Maybe Glasnost has taken care of that.
They had a few other policies.
But I think everybody had to do right-handed work and learn to write right-handed. And these kids in school, I wonder what that had as effect.
I assume the same type of effect it had on Lewis Carroll and lots of other folk who were, imagine being, 5-6 years old when you're starting to write and your real natural tendency is to do it one way and you're you know, there's this fascist figure over you saying don't, and could mess you up in lots of ways. Apparently it did. Yes.
This unbalance, which does seem to be true about our culture today, I've been thinking about what might be the historical roots of that, and two things that occurred to me right away were the public schooling or universal schooling, spending so and so many hours a day in a room, sitting down, not moving too much, and having this kind of, you know, these kind of activities to do that are mostly mental. And then the other one was, you know, sort of the scientific, yeah.
Keep going. I reminded me of an organization I founded.
The other one was just sort of the scientific industrial revolution, you know, where the application of real strict kinds of procedures and recordings, and I mean, scientific experimentation and so on, really required that kind of thinking.
Sure.
Do you have other ideas about?
I think both of those are probably predominant. It's interesting, William Blake, who unfortunately apparently was right-handed, I'll try not to hold that against him, and in my mind one of the most highly developed light brains ever, never went to school except to art school. And he produced some of the greatest lyrical poetry in the English language and the finest what's often called prophetic writing, and some wonderful art. And he, in fact, in some of his poems, expresses how happy he was that he never had to go to school.
You know, being an electrician and a mechanic, the thought as you drew the circle up there just came to me, the clock going clockwise goes to the right. So you screws to the right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in some machinery, technology has found out the machinery would not stay together unless it had a counterclockwise screw in it, so that you had to screw to the left to screw the screw into the hole.
Isn't that hard?
Yeah, because you know, I mean, maybe it goes the other way, and it's like walking backwards.
Yeah.
You know, but somewhere down the line, someone noticed what you're trying to suggest, that you had to get on the other side in order to make that machinery work.
Yeah. I have to tell you a little about that organization. It's not really a clock. It's supposed to be a chair with a line through it, and I'm the founder and lifelong chairman of what I call the California Reformed Anti-Sedentary Society. And our motto is get off your ass and support crass. So I kept forgetting this is tape. And another one called Corn Bottom, which is a committee organized to get Ronnie and Nancy back to the movies. we want to make them offers that they cannot possibly refuse, that if they just stop messing around with the real world, they can remake any movie. He can be Rhett Butler. He can have any leading lady he wants, Brooke Shields. Although there is one exception, I call it the Jane exclusion. He cannot have a leading lady whose first name starts with Jane. No Jane Wyman, no Jane Mansfield, no Jane Fonda, and we don't think he could handle Jane Russell. Then there's a committee to re-erect the president, but we're getting off the subject. Is it about that time? Any last comments or questions?
Yes. I've been looking at that. What's that say there right below gold?
I was talking about hemispherically training or ambidexterity, and then I said hemispheric balance, a balance between those hemispheres. Thank you very much.